Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Gold and bonds appear to be on an upward trend. He also comments on gold, the U.S. dollar, and crude. Veteran BC trader Victor Adair tells us if the Dow rally will continue and why the shine is off the U.S. dollar after a long run higher. He believes the markets will switch their focus from inflation to recession. Publisher of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, checks in from Florida to talk about interest rates, energy, the U.S. dollar, deflation, and the decline of America's major cities. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Check him out on Twitter at @chartsbyRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, what was the big story on the markets this week?
Well, I mean, now you're dealing with Canadian interest rates jumping up by 0.5% thanks to the Bank of Canada. But, you know, of note, the open market, the free market where we trade, is way ahead of what the Fed is doing. The bond market had an exceptionally good rally here, about 12% off the low. And we had been looking for the long bond, which got down around 117.5. We've been looking for that to rally up into the 129 to 132 bracket. Well, it kissed 132 this week, nice big rally, came off what we call a capitulation low back in October, and so definitely time to, you know, bank some profits as far as that bond trade is concerned. And the overall picture, though, for bonds is that we're looking for a broad consolidation here, probably get down and come close to retesting that low we put in October. Everybody will get excited again about how bad things are. But, you know, it's a consolidation process that I think is just ready to come into the cards there just now.
What's going on with gold?
The gold market, you know, we looked at this last week. The good rally off the bottom, that was a triple bottom, and they just took out the week longs right on the last day of the low back in the first week of November. So first rally retraced 38% from the March high, and now we've gone up and taken out that high and just sitting marginally above it, just around $1,800. The base that we've got here, everything under the August highs up until now, very similar to other bases that we've seen. The 1975-76 bottom, which was, you know, one of the best historically. I've got four other examples that are very similar to this. The key now is going to be how well we hold around the 1770-ish range. And, ideally this rally, as we mentioned a week ago, 1870 would be the first or the next target on the upside. But this is the type of market that needs to stair-step its way higher. You don't want to have it give back too much on corrections. And, you know, they can last 2 to 5 days, you know, nice type of pullback just to make people a little cautious, and then they come to life like they did the first part of this week. And at the tail end of the week, came back to trade sort of middle of the range. But the trend is up at this point now until proven otherwise. And we're kind of enjoying the move, and we'll see just how much it's got in the way of legs. The stocks, like the GDX, GDXJ, been moving pretty much in tandem with the gold market. Sold off a shade at the end of the week, but not enough to be of concern. So, stick with that one for now as well.
What's happening with crude?
Oil market, the key to us was the $76 low that was put in and tested. So that was put in September. It was retested on a closing basis about 10 days ago. Got a decent bounce, but couldn't get back even to the middle of its recent trading range. And 71.5. Now, because it's taken out that key support, that whole trading range from the September low up to the high at 93, we can measure that, the height of that, as a potential move to the downside, and target becomes close to $60. So I wouldn't be in too much of a rush to be doing too much in there right now. Some of the stocks are looking not too bad. They're holding in, but as a whole, the sector is reasonably heavy, so I would not be rushing into any new energy plays until we get a better low in the crude oil price itself.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar, we're into a bit of a consolidation with a downside bias this last 2.5 weeks here, and this is all sitting at about that Fibonacci correction point coming off the low we had back in 2021. It's also sitting on the 50-week moving average. So this is an important support level. We mentioned last week, if it tends to turn the corner here and you get up through 106 on the dollar index, that would not be good for any of the commodities, in particular the gold and silver market. So we'll keep an eye on that level as a key as far as the U.S. dollar index is concerned. Canadian versus the U.S. Actually held in reasonably well this week, considering how badly the oil market's been hit. Still think that the bias here is down to the downside, with the 75.5 having been a good resistance level or a strong resistance level on the rally in October. So, look at the Canadian maybe as a trading range with a downside bias, probably going to take out that 72 cent low before things are finished.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC, but still very active in the markets. He's speaking to us from Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always fun to talk with you. Thank you for having me on.
So how is life on the island, man?
It's just fine, man.
For most of this year, the big question in the markets has been how high will the Fed push interest rates as they try to quell inflation, and when will they stop raising rates? In your recent blogs on victoradair.ca, you seem to think the big question is changing to when is the recession going to hit, and what will that do to the markets? Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I think for the most of the past year or so, I mean, if we go back a little better than a year, the Fed was still talking transitory, like they thought inflation was going to just be a temporary blip and then we'd be back to, the way we were. But then about a year ago now, you know, you could see the signals anyway coming from the Fed that they were going to reverse their position on that. And as most of this year went past, the Fed rather aggressively compared to what they've been like over the past 20, 30 years, maybe actually go all the way back to Volcker, that's 40 years. The Fed has been more aggressive than even they thought they were going to be, as inflation seemed to be more, let's say sticky. That's one of the words they use for inflation. In other words, it was high and staying high, and they began to worry not only about inflation, but I think even more so about what they called inflation expectations. If people get of the mindset that inflation is sort of a permanent thing, then that changes behavior of consumers, of producers of things, of people who make investments. It changes everybody's view of the world. So the Fed wanted to get inflation down somewhere around 2% was their sort of preferred level. That's a 2% annual rate of increase. And they really only had a couple of tools to do that. One was to raise interest rates, and another was to drain liquidity out of the system so that there wasn't so much spending. Let's just feel that. I'm almost embarrassed to say it that simply, but that's kind of really, you get down to the nuts and bolts of it. Anyhow, we saw the stock market, for instance, react. You know, prices were falling from virtually all-time highs around the beginning of the year. And one of the things there, the stock market was worried, as other markets were worried in their own way, that if the Fed pushed interest rates higher and higher and higher, then the calculation as to what was good value for a stock would go down. So then, of course, people were looking at inflation and saying, well, maybe inflation isn't going to stay high. Maybe it'll start to come down. And if that's the case, then the Fed won't need to keep pushing interest rates high. And if we can figure out when the Fed's going to stop raising interest rates and maybe, you know, Katie bar the door, start to lower interest rates, well, that will just be an excellent time to step in and buy risk assets, particularly stocks. So, yeah, that was really kind of the drill. Now, there were folks, you know, the wet blankets, the David Rosenberg, God bless him, of the world, who were saying, hey, the consequences of the Fed pushing interest rates up the way they are is going to push the economy into a recession. It's going to cause people to lose their jobs, and we might have a deflationary environment. Well, initially, these folks kind of got poo-pooed because, you know, when the party's rolling, who wants to have a wet blanket around? But I think here, I mean, there's always been folks that were saying, hey, don't get too aggressive here. There's going to be trouble ahead. But it's the proportion of people who have been kind of shifting gears. In other words, saying, well, you know, maybe these folks that were talking about recession coming weren't so crazy after all. And I think we've kind of seen a change in the market. And I'm going to say the market, I mean, across all asset classes here, we've seen a change in the expectations. You know, yeah, the Fed is going to slow interest rates at some point. And, you know, right now it seems like maybe March or so of next year, maybe before that. And, but it's the consequences of what they have done. Maybe it will have this dramatic slowing of the economy so we go into a recession. So I think that kind of across the different markets that I look at and that I trade, there's been this change of tone from, you know, trying to guess when the Fed was going to stop raising rates and then hallelujah, you know, buy everything that's not nailed down to now, gee whiz. Maybe the consequences of these raising rates is the thing we ought to be worried about.
WTI crude oil prices dropped to around $70 this week. That's down from the 130 highs we saw when the Russians invaded Ukraine. What's causing this big drop?
You know, it's a bit of the similar thinking to what I was just describing. There was certainly for a period of time in, I guess, I mean, maybe the apex of this was just after the Russians invaded Ukraine and the West started throwing sanctions on Russia. And one of them seemed to be that the West was going to stop buying crude oil exports from Russia. And Russia is the world's largest exporter of crude oil. I mean, closer to Russia, Saudi, the U.S., let's say the Russians right up there. So maybe that was one of the things that put us up to $130 or thereabouts. The forward markets, in other words, what is crude oil going to be in the future, were showing that there was a real tightness for crude for immediate delivery. Like, people were worried about, can you get some oil tomorrow? You know, a year from now, we'll worry about that then. So we had a real premium on the nearby contracts in crude. And the worry was all about supply, or they call it lack of supply. We're not going to have enough. And now, over the past certainly couple of months here, as prices have come down significantly, and you're right, we're just down up to about $70, and that's the lowest we've seen in a year. The worry seems to be now about whether there's enough demand to take all the oil off the market. OPEC, of course, has, I should say OPEC Plus, and that's basically OPEC and Russia together, have taken steps to reduce the amount of oil that they're producing. They've been saying they look ahead and see demand weakening. And that's really been the driver. Now, in markets, you know, that when, say, a market gets in a mood of one kind, it'll push and kind of gain some momentum going that way, whether it's up or down. So as the thinking started to shift to worries about demand and prices started to trend lower, then maybe people of a bearish persuasion would jump on the bandwagon. Let me give you a better example here would be gasoline prices, and people see gasoline prices. I'm going to assume a lot of our listeners probably have a pretty good idea, you know, let's say within $5 or so of where WTI is trading, but, you know, certainly if they're drivers driving a lot, they know exactly, you know, what the gasoline price is. So gasoline from a year ago doubled from where it was in December last year to the May highs we had following the Russian invasion, and also a number of other factors, including just not having the right kind of crude in the right places to refine it to produce gasoline. But since then, it's fallen in half. So again, you know, consumers looking at the price of gasoline coming down the way it has, one of the side effects of that has been that the consumer's view in one of the, I think it was the University of Michigan was released earlier, at the end of this week. Anyway, the consumer's view as to where inflation will be early next year has dropped dramatically, and that's very tied to what they see happening to the price of gasoline when they go down the road and see that price posted up there. So, where we're at now, this decline, one of the other side effects of that I find really interesting is that while crude oil and let's say fossil fuels have had this dramatic decline over the past several months, the share prices of a lot of the major oil companies, or let's say some of the ETFs that would have a basket of oil and gas companies that in their holdings, have not had this dramatic decline. And I wondered about that. I had a question on my website, I guess, 2 weeks ago. I saw some interesting answers back on that. And one of them was, you know, the oil companies are no longer, I should say, oil and gas companies are no longer just a levered play on the price of the product. You know, they are free cash flow generating machines, as opposed to when they were, you know, drill baby drill, they're spending money like there was no tomorrow. They were burning cash. That a lot of the energy companies, and let's say particularly fossil fuel energy companies, good dividends, you know, that's well covered by the cash flow that they're earning. So that maybe kind of answers the question to some degree as to why we have seen oil prices and gasoline prices drop, but we haven't seen the share prices of the oil and gas producing companies drop.
You were consistently bullish on the U.S. dollar for all of last year, most of this year, but started to change your mind a couple of months ago. The U.S. dollar index has fallen about 10% since its highs in September. Why is that, and where do you think the U.S. buck goes from here?
Okay, let's say that, I mean, you're right. For all of 21, I was bullish on the U.S. dollar, and I think we pretty much nailed the inflection point back in in January of 2021. But the rise of the dollar, and it started to rise then, but it really started to gain momentum to the upside a little better than a year ago. And then I guess it really kicked into high gear, say, August or so of this year. And I'm going to say that was largely tied to the market's perception that the Federal Reserve would be the most aggressive of the central banks in raising interest rates. A real bonus or an additional reason for why the U.S. dollar really started to accelerate the upside, say, earlier this year, following the invasion, the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, I think a lot of the world, the currency trading world anyway, where money could move around, saw the U.S. dollar as a safer place to have your money than, say, invested in Europe or anywhere else. And in the world of currency trading, by far and away, the biggest volume pair is the trading the U.S. dollar against the euro currency. So if people were worried about Europe, instead of having your money invested in Europe, you know, you swing your money, put it in the United States. Now, clearly, the problems for Europe that are caused by having a war on their eastern frontier haven't gone away, and maybe in some respects they've exacerbated. But certainly the first thing about the Fed being the most aggressive central bank, at least in the market's opinion here, has toned down. And again, as I was saying a few minutes ago, when a market gets trending one way, it'll build momentum and sort of, you know, what's going up keeps going up. And that happens maybe more in the currency markets than any of the other markets that I trade. So when the Fed got on a tear, going to the upside, and I've seen this, I mean, I've traded currencies for more than 40 years, that these trends just seem to go way further than seems to make any sense, and they turn on a dime and go the other way. And so far, that's what we've had. The U.S. dollar index, which is usually heavily weighted to European currencies, with Japanese yen and some of this and that thrown in there, is down about 10% from the highs it made. But the highs were in September were the highest the dollar index had been in 20 years. So it had a hell of a run. So we've come back here, I think, because markets are starting to see a change with the Fed. Something I've noticed is that European shares have been more aggressively bid than American shares here the past couple of months. So there's, I think, a thought with some people, hey, the European shares got to be a bargain because the euro currency dropped down below a buck, you know, compared to the U.S. dollar, whereas, you know, not that long ago, maybe it was a dollar and a half. So, you know, they've had a 30% off sale, as it were. So there was certainly been some of that where capital started to flow back to Europe. Where we go from here, you know, I'm going to say I'm a little from Missouri on this break in the dollar. I think, for instance, if we go ahead into a recession in the United States as the beginning of the year, or that's when folks realize we're in a recession that may have already started, that a recession will hit the rest of the world harder than it hits the United States, and that will put a bid in the U.S. dollar. The safety and opportunity in the United States, I think, is sort of always a function, and there's probably going to be this or that to worry about in terms of geopolitical problems around the world, and that'll keep some share of capital flowing to the United States. Yeah, I think the 10% or so correction we've had, I'd be looking for the U.S. dollar to do a little better as we go into the first month or two of the new year. And if it doesn't, you know, if it maybe rallies a little bit and that seems to run out of steam, you know, then for me, I love a top to a market where it makes a high, sells off some, comes back, but can't get back to the high it was, and then rolls over the second time. You know, that's kind of a green light special for me to get short. So, you know, I'm not married to the U.S. dollar. What I like to find is what I call sort of asymmetrical risk-reward opportunities. So if the U.S. dollar, after making this 20-year high, and selling off 10%, rallies back but doesn't have any steam to it, starts to roll over, well then, you know, I'll be shorting it.
In early October, the Dow Jones was down about 20% from its all-time high hit in January. Since those lows, the Dow bounced back about 6,000 points last week. It was down only about 6% from its all-time high. What drove the great seven-week-long rally, and where does the market go from here?
Yeah, I think the rally that we had, let's call it in the 2 months of October and November, something like that. I saw a piece of research this morning somewhere. I'm forgetting exactly where I saw it, but they were saying this was the biggest 2 month rally in the Dow like in forever. And you know, it was 6,000 points. That was about a 20% rally. 6,000 points in the Dow was a smoking rally. You know, to put that in perspective, the rally started on October the 13th. And on October 13th, the CPI number, monthly report for the United States, came out, and it was, from the market's perspective, bad news. Like, the interest rates were staying higher for longer, and that would mean, I should say, inflation was staying higher for longer, and that would mean the Fed would be more aggressive and blah, blah, blah. So it's like the bottom fell out of the market, and we made two-year lows in the major indices that morning, and then turned on a dime and started to rally. And we, during that rally, the thinking, as I say, that started to be, hey, you know, inflation's probably peaked. That means at some point here soon, the Fed's going to stop being so aggressive with raising rates and might even stop raising rates altogether. So, hey, stocks are now, you know, different indices. I mean, I think we had the NASDAQ made its all-time high in November of last year, and at the October 13th lows, it was down nearly 40%. That's the index. And some of the major stocks within the index were down more than that. So, hey, it's a bargain. People were jumping in to buy the names that they like. So we had this rally largely fueled, I believe, on the thinking that, okay, the Fed, that's been our biggest enemy here by raising interest rates so aggressively, is going to chill out. And that kind of sets up an opportunity of saying, hey, so are there some bargains here? And in the back of a lot of folks' mind, and, you know, God bless them, the investment management industry has done a hell of a good job of selling people on the idea that stocks only go up. You know, they say, look at the long-term chart. You know, go back to the First World War and look at that. You know, we're way higher than we used to be. Well, you know, so is everything else. But anyway, people have that in their mind. You know, before we made the highs at the beginning of this year, you know, you had these expressions like Tina, you know, there is no alternative. Like, you got to be in stocks. There is a massive segment of the investment industry where they have passive investments. They say to people, do not try to time when you get in or out of the market. Do not try to pick stocks. Just buy the whole market. Keep putting money in there on a regular basis and do that over a 30-year period and you're going to be rich. That's it. That's all you need to know. So there's now trillions of dollars have flowed into the market in that passive, packaging. And people would see the sell-off in the market that we had this year as, oh, hey, here's an opportunity to add to my portfolio, you know, at reduced prices. So, great, let's just keep buying. So, yeah, the market does love to go up. And in an inflationary environment, you know, why not? You know, things should go up. But I think here just very recently we started to have a change of tune about that where after such a terrific rally, as I say, 20% on the Dow in 6 weeks, that's pretty good. I think people are starting to have second thoughts again about this recession idea. And, you know, 70% of the economy in the U.S. is going to be driven by consumer spending. So if consumers are getting tapped out, and there's different stats will tell you that that's the way it's going, that maybe now's not the time to be throwing money at the stock market like there's no tomorrow. So anyway, that's my view on that.
The bond market has had a terrible year. Some analysts say it's been the worst year ever. That's important for many reasons, but is it crucial for pension funds because they usually have a significant allocation to bonds? What are your thoughts?
Yes, short answer. And yes, the bonds have had a horrible year. You know, you go back to the summer of 2020, so 2.5 years ago, bond yields in the United States were at, let's go whole hog, say, at an all-time low. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note was 0.5%. And certainly in my lifetime, that was the lowest it has ever been, and it goes back way further than that. Now, that was when COVID was hitting and, you know, people were losing jobs and staying home and the governments were writing stimulative checks or stimmy checks, as they call it, to try to get the economy going. Nobody knew what was going to happen and bonds were safety and there you are. So since then, bond markets have been rising. Now, the rise in the bond market very much followed the trajectory of the rise in interest rates, you know, the Fed pushing interest rates higher. So the bond market was trending higher, and then for most of this year, when I say trending higher, I mean yields, really surged higher, so that we got up to about 4.3% yield on the 10-year in September, early October. Now, since then, and everybody and his dog was speculators anyway, were short the bond market. So it maybe got oversold, and people would start to unwind some of those positions. You mentioned the pension funds. Typically, pension funds have a significant allocation to bonds, and part of the thinking would be, you know, the pension fund liabilities, in other words, the money they have to pay out to pensioners, is a long-term liability. So you put a long-term asset, like a 30-year bond, in your portfolio, and you're matching your asset and liability duration. So it makes good sense to do that. And you know, there's also if you went back to maybe when I was a boy, you know, the pension funds would have all of their money in bonds. You know, stocks were too damn risky, was the thinking. So as time has gone by, they've allocated money to different things, certainly stocks. These days, kind of the classic portfolio mix is 60% stocks, 40% bonds. But pension funds have also got into private equity, different real estate investments, and all kinds of alternative investments and so on. So it's not like they're just stocks and bonds. But with stock market down, as I said earlier, the NASDAQ, for instance, down 40% at the lows from the highs of last year. The Dow is down 20-odd percent. The S&P down about 25%. And the bond market down. And the other thing with the poor pension funds was their liabilities were up. In other words, because of the cost of living adjustments they have to make, they're going to be having to pay out more money than they were counting on, you know, a year or two ago. So they were getting it from both sides. Their liabilities were rising and their assets were shrinking. On paper, now, you know, they can mark them to market and say, well, this is just transitory and, you know, things will get sorted out later. But yeah, it's been tough for pension funds that way, just as a lot of people that are approaching retirement usually have a higher percentage of bonds in their retirement portfolio than they used to. When they were younger, they might have more stocks, and as they get older, they have more bonds. So a combination of stocks and bonds, both down at the same time, has been bad news for a lot of investors.
Gold prices have jumped nearly $200 from the 30-month lows they hit in September. You've often told us a strong U.S. dollar and rising interest rates are a toxic environment for gold. Can we assume that the recent jump in gold prices is related to a weaker U.S. buck?
Yes. Yes, you can. I mean, it's really very much that simple. I think that the gold price hit, as you say, a 30-month low in September. And it wasn't just the price. I mean, I keep track of how much trading is being done in the gold futures markets, not only how much trading in terms of volume, but how much people want to hang on to their gold position, you know, for days and weeks and months at a time. I also track that same kind of data in the gold bullion ETF market. And certainly in the ETF market, I think it's a little different. I think traders who want to get in and out of the market quickly will more likely use the paper gold market that is the futures markets, whereas other folks that have a longer-term time horizon might look at the gold bullion ETF market. Whatever. The ETF market has just been nothing but sellers since the Russian invasion this year, and before that they'd been sellers. So the market had spiked up, you know, fear and trembling on the Russian invasion, and then that kind of blew over, and they've been selling. Certainly the gold mining company share ETFs had a bad period as well. So we got to this environment where, yeah, the U.S. dollar is surging, interest rates, and particularly real interest rates, been trending higher and then really ran higher in the sort of, let's say, from March or so of this year to about September, October of this year, the real interest rates really surged higher. So it's just a real toxic environment for gold, you know, with high, strong dollar, rising interest rates, and people just not interested in owning it or actually selling it. So the market, I think, got really sold out, as it were, here a month or so ago. And then, you know, there's this thinking that, hey, maybe the Fed's about done rising. The U.S. dollar started weakening, and even lately here, real interest rates have been backing off a little bit. So a market that had been almost left for dead, as it were, has got some new life. So we've had a good jump in the price. Now, you just heard me say a few minutes ago, I think, don't count the U.S. dollar out. And I think there's also more to the gold rally. I didn't want to forget this. I mean, China just announced, they bought some more gold for their central bank. Now, the Chinese don't give you a regular update on their gold holdings, but we're seeing central banks around the world buy more gold. Maybe they kind of saw it as a bargain, you know, with the inflation weakening the purchasing power of different fiat currencies. Maybe some of the central banks decided that was a good reason. For whatever reasons, the central banks have been taking down a lot of gold this year, so that may have helped give the price a kick to the upside.
Victor, anything else you think we should be keeping a close eye on as we close out the year?
Anything else? I mean, I pay very close attention to what's going on in the interest rate markets, the currency markets, the commodity markets, and the equity markets. Those are the markets that I pay attention to in terms of markets. I think in what I watch about those markets is what I think how markets are positioned, what the psychology is in the market, what sentiment is like. I mean, let's say I think a market has had a great bullish run, whatever it is. I'm unlikely to just jump in and buy it because I think it's going higher. I'm more inclined to think, okay, maybe it's left town without me, or this train's left town without me. I don't care. There'll be more trains to catch. I am constantly looking for what I would call just a good risk-reward opportunity. It's much more important to me about when to get into a market as a buyer or a seller rather than the why to do it. So what that really means is I try to find a spot where I can put a position on, again, whether I'm long or short, where I'm going to risk X amount of money and know, okay, if I lose that much money, I'm wrong. And it's not the amount of money, it's that if the market goes to such and such a level against me, then I'm wrong and I'm out. But if I'm right on my idea that I should be making, you know, a multiple of what I'm willing to lose on the trade. So, yeah, I guess I don't believe in much of anything. You know, there's been so many stories, and I just have seen in my career of trading so many people embrace a story and sort of go down with the ship. You know, whether it's, you know, it's marijuana stocks or cryptocurrencies or, you know, people that thought copper was going to go to $100 a pound because of the electrification of the world, and, you know, it hasn't, and on and on and on. There are stories out there. You got to kind of, you know, I mean, if there's a good story going on and the markets have on a tear, yeah, you don't stepping in, short it, you know, maybe it's a good time to buy it, but just be aware that, you know, the stories kind of come and go. And yeah, probably that would be my New Year's resolution is, you know, just be careful about believing all the stories.
Yeah, I think the Bitcoin FTX thing is probably the best example of don't always believe a great narrative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that's what Wall Street does. They design, and when I say Wall Street, I mean, you know, the markets. You know, they'll design product, give people what they want, you know. Let's say, here's another one. I mean, ESG, holy mackerel. The last couple of years, I mean, if you said that, you know, you were the toxic waste handling company ESG, you know, you doubled your share price. ESG just drew a lot of money. And I mentioned earlier in our talk here about passive investing. People kind of bought the story of the stock market always goes up, just keep putting money in, you know, but it's a dip off, it's an opportunity, buy more. Don't try to time getting in and out. Don't try to pick stocks, just buy the whole thing. I mean, that's probably the biggest story ever. And at some point, I think, you know, people who actually do their homework and figure out what is the right thing to buy and what's the right time to buy it will have their day in the sun, and the folks that just figure you can throw money at the market and forget it will be disappointed.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, that was fun. You kind of drew that out of me. I didn't know I was going to say that.
Well,
listen, have a great Christmas, Jimmy.
You too. All the best.
Okay. Cheers.
My guest has been Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, founder and editor of Rick's Picks online at rickackerman.com. Rick, welcome back to This Week in Money, and where are you speaking to us this week?
Well, I'm in Florida, and I want to thank you for inviting me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
Do you have a special offer for our listeners?
Very special indeed. If you go to rickackerman.com, you can instantly access everything on my site, including a couple of chat rooms that I think are among the very best in the trading world, and also get my daily explicitly detailed trade recommendations that are updated 24/7. This is a free 2-week trial. It requires no credit card. Just again, go to rickackerman.com, and up top at the tab that says free stuff, free resources, just click on that and you can sign up for a 2-week trial.
For people new to Rick's Picks, can you just give us a little picture of it?
Well, the chat room takes a little bit of getting used to. There's some jargon that we use that's particular to my technical forecasting system, but we've got an amazing bunch of folks in there. You know, most of them, it's not the usual Tower of Babel, because everybody speaks more or less the same technical language. A lot of my subscribers are very good in using my hidden pivot method. But they bring to it methods of their own, and if you pay attention and you develop a little bit of a taste for some of the better technicians in there, you can make a lot of money just following timely suggestions. Yesterday, for instance, trading in crude and the E-mini S&Ps, but all sorts of vehicles are traded, and I encourage my guys, men and women, to put out actionable advice in the trading room. So it's and the daily touts, I update them each day. I start every Sunday evening with a core list that kind of gives you a good overview of the markets, but with very specific price targets and trend forecasts gold, silver, the E-mini S&Ps, Bitcoin, crude oil, the dollar, and some other things that are very important to the big picture.
The Bank of Canada raised its trend-setting rate by 50 basis points this week. What do you think the Fed's going to do when it holds its December meeting?
It's like which state's going to grab the primary, you know? Yeah. I don't think the Fed wants to be second in line, taking its cue from Canada. I think we're going to get a 50 basis point hike this next time, but possibly 75. The economic numbers, and this is within the context of a recession that's spreading globally, the numbers have been strengthening. I guess I'll use that word in quotes. So we should be prepared for the Fed to err on the hawkish side. And the more so because they've been, I guess, getting and believing their own good press. Bloomberg was out there today with a purely planted headline about how the Fed is damping things without creating some sort of deflationary collapse. But I don't think it's possible to make that assumption when they've subjected literally quadrillions of dollars worth of borrowing to very significantly higher interest rates. So it's a little bit premature to be celebrating this Fed success in killing inflation, which they haven't, as something it's not going to precipitate out as a deflationary bust. It absolutely has to.
Now, I was confused. U.S. job numbers were a bit better than they expected. And so many people were saying, oh, that's bad news. How is that bad news? I mean, can you not have inflation and jobs at the same time?
Two things about the job numbers. Mm-hmm. They're worthless. They're absolute rubbish. And even if they did mean something, no one could say what it is. It's pointless to guess what impact it's going to have on the markets. But to talk about job losses or gains in the context of an economy where there, you know, whatever it is, 9 million working age men having dropped out of the workforce, and the market itself is really crazy because anybody with brick and mortar retail, you know, restaurants, stores, they're all closing down. So the economy is reorganizing, and the layoffs at some of these tech firms, including, you know, the upper tier, is not encouraging as to how many new jobs are going to be created to take the place of these brick and mortar jobs that are being lost. So the economy is in a secular flux, and I mean secular over the course of many generations. This is a big change that we're seeing now. And, you know, to try to read any meaning into weekly or monthly job figures is ridiculous.
Now, one of the big factors in the inflation rate is the price of energy. And I just heard that diesel prices have come down substantially. That should, in the long run, ease shipping costs. But will they just keep charging you fuel surcharges anyway because they got away with it before?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we're used to having energy prices be very flexible on the way up, but very inflexible coming down. In other words, it doesn't take much to drive prices higher, but boy, it takes a lot of falling crude prices and natural gas prices to cause those end goods and services prices to fall as well. So as the commodity prices fall, you know, we can always sort of cross our fingers and hope that the trend continues to at least ameliorate some of the inflationary impact. But of course, at the user end, at the final goods and services end, it takes a long time for lower commodity prices to factor into those markets. And I'm looking at crude in particular. It's currently trading at 72.56 a barrel. That's basis the January contract. And I'm looking for 67.74. In other words, another 5 points or so for crude to fall. And then I'll kind of reassess.
Your thoughts on Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter?
Well, just this my current commentary makes him the man of the year. I've got a big picture of Elon Musk at the top of the commentary, and I think he's really done some remarkable things. It's somewhat unfortunate that he had to pay so much to make his point. $44 billion for the company was about $43.999 billion overpriced, and I think anybody could see that for what Twitter was offering, any group of techies and a few high school dropouts to do the coding could start their own Twitter for $5 million. But Musk paid a lot to make a point, but he's at least making the most of that, in part by being one of the most powerful, in a practical way, advocates for free speech. But also, it's fun to watch him clean out the scoundrels at Twitter and tell the stories of their depredations.
Well, certainly, you have to, if you're going to recover $44 billion, you have to make it profitable. And so many of these high-tech companies really did seem to be pretty top-heavy, with people spending more time in the games room than at their own desks.
Yeah, and you know, it's almost like in real estate, the price of one high-tech showcase company, the margin, effectively sets, it can reset the prices for all of them. So, you know, I've used in our discussions the example of a cul-de-sac where all the homes sell from $2 to $3 million, let's say down on the peninsula in San Francisco. But if we should have some hard economic times and one homeowner gets on the ropes and sells his house for $1.5 million in distress, then every home in that cul-de-sac has been cut in half, the value. So it's the same with tech companies. You know, for a while, we sort of had everybody kind of went along with the nonsense that these tech companies are worth even $1 trillion, you know, and that a company like Tesla would be worth more than all the other car manufacturers combined. But I think that the effective repricing of Tesla, in part through discussions of what it's worth rather than actual share price, which has come down hard enough, it's effectively put all the other companies like Apple and, Chipotle, Beyond Meat, Google, Microsoft, it's all put them on notice that that their prices are absolutely, that they're surreal. And of course, the joblessness of many of these $300,000 and $400,000 or $500,000 a year Twitter drones is also a warning, a shot across the bow for all of the employees working at some of these top tier companies. So it's going to take a while for that to factor into the markets, but let's say that the facade is gone.
Bull and bear cases for the new year. First, your bullish thoughts on 2023.
Well, unfortunately, I think the scoundrels will continue to profit. The refiners, big energy companies, they've been in a really rip-roaring uptrend, and I believe that's going to continue to happen to the detriment and great expense of all of us. You know, I guess the only way you can sort of hedge prices at the pump is to buy shares in Exxon. Concerning the other scoundrels, the ones who run the banks, the bank index has been coming down most of this year from around 150 to a current 100. So it's had a pretty good haircut, but it's a haircut within an enormous uptrend that started down below 60. So I think that the bank sector, for better or worse of all of us, is going to be resurgent in 2023.
What are your bearish thoughts for the new year?
Well, it's not hard to sort of list out a dozen things that could cause the world to collapse tomorrow into a deflationary abyss. And they're all there. They're all very real. And I think that they will eventually come to bear on the economy. They have to. But a couple weeks ago in my commentary, I put out a chart, an Apple chart, that suggests that for all of the negatives, the things that look like potential catastrophes, 2023 could be a kind of muddle through year. Apple itself is within a large channel on the weekly chart. And although I think that Apple will eventually trade under 50 bucks, it's currently 142. I think it's going under 50 over the long term. When you look at the channel, you could see it sort of staying within it, and not breaking below 100 even, for a good long while, certainly to take us through 2023. And because of the crucial importance of Apple in the portfolios of virtually every money manager, the stock is always going to be the best bellwether we have. And there's no way the stock market as a whole is going to collapse if Apple is not collapsing. So again, there is sort of from a technical standpoint, a muddle through argument for Apple that could suggest that even though we could have some big swings in 2023, they would not be of the imagined consequence. The bulls, of course, are going to be saying on the upswings that we're going to break out to new highs, and the bears will be saying, hey, we're going to crash, but there is a good case that it could stay within the channel. And if I had to tip either way, just based on the current price action within that channel, if unexpectedly, at least to me, there were going to be a big move in one direction, a breakout, I would say it would be to the upside rather than the downside. And just don't ask me why, because I am a perma bear, but the simple reason, the simple rationale would be that it's not really a market that's based on earnings or the economy or anything else. It's just a function of how much money is out there jangling around. And I use that word money in quotes.
Could a partial bullish and partial bearish case then be the likely outcome for 2023?
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely a part of the view that I was just talking about. Bullish, but never quite exuberantly so, but bearish at times too, but not in the way of a collapse. So, you know, gurus hate to say that not much is going to happen. Everybody sort of looks to us to predict that the market's going to crash, or it's going to do this, or it's going to do that. So I feel like I'm sort of going out on a limb saying, hey, 2023 could be just nobody's idea of a good year.
In the stock markets, do you think there are sectors that are likely to outperform in 2023?
Well, we did mention the scoundrels, the banks and the big oil. The pharmaceutical companies are always going to be players, even though they have their ups and downs based on perceptions that ebb and flow as to whether they really own us and our health, really. You know, if you watch any primetime television, you get the idea that big pharma really does, they own the whole show. I mean, it seems like there's unlimited money to advertise an unlimited variety of drugs. And, we all know that we're being over-medicated, over-treated, and, you know, to make the worst case, we're being killed by these drugs slowly or sometimes quickly. But, you know, they're going to be not just in the game, but a dominant force.
What are your thoughts for real estate in the new year?
We're in a silent collapse right now. All the pieces are in place, really. With mortgages pushing above 7%, you can understand why there are no transactions. People who in their homes are thinking, geez, where would I go and how much would I pay? So if there's any, you know, real estate movement at all, it's just for cash sales. People come in and don't do mortgages. There's certainly a lot of that happening in Florida. People are retiring from New York and high tax states. So they come down here and it doesn't really matter whether mortgages are 3% or 10%. They're simply cash deals. But I don't think that the cash deals are going to sustain the real estate market as a whole. And I think on the whole, it got extremely dangerously overbought. The prices went bonkers for no reason. A lot of it simply based on, you know, COVID shortages and also the squeeze that was put on renters. Rents have increased so much that a lot of renters got desperate enough to say, hey, you know, I'll put 55% of my disposable income into monthly mortgage payments. So that's clearly unsustainable. And so you've had a situation where, particularly at the mid-ish high range, like, you know, where Margate, New Jersey, a place where I grew up, the nicer places go for anywhere from $1.5 million to $20 million down in Longport. And at that level, you've got the sellers thinking they'd like to downsize, but screw it. You know, I'll just wait for the market to come back a little bit, wait for bids to firm, because as everybody knows, we're not having bidding wars anymore for real estate, for homes. So the sellers are sitting tight, and the buyers more and more are realizing that the economy is sinking. It's just too weak to justify paying up. So the bid and the offer, the spread is widening. And even though there's not enough transaction volume to have good price discovery, when the market finally comes alive, I think it's going to be energized by desperate sellers. And then you'll have the effect that we were talking about earlier, where all of those $2 million homes in the cul-de-sac get cut in half because one buyer has had to make an urgent sale.
Your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
Well, as a hardcore, and this means for the last 40 years, make that 50, almost 50 years, a hardcore deflationist, I've always been a dollar bull, but I would have to concede that, you know, the dollar is in more than a mild correction here. When you consider the huge run-up that the dollar experienced over a number of years, though, it's easy to justify the case for a really nasty correction. You know, we came off a dollar index low just beneath 90, and the move in the dollar index was up to 115. But I've always expected that the dollar would test generational highs up near 120 eventually, and that would be congruent with my prediction of a deflationary end game for the U.S. economy and the financial system. Again, I think it's absolutely unavoidable, but that's a big, very big picture event, and it will be concurrent with the collapse in the economy. So when I talk about strength in the dollar, it's when it finally does turn around, when this correction ends, that's going to be the sounding of the trumpets from on high. It really will be taps for the global economy. And in part because the dollar is hugely larger than the Federal Reserve can manage. Even the central banks working in concert can't control the monster, the size of which they've created with dollar borrowing in this world. And we're not going to shift into some other currency or some digital currency or whatever, because no currency can handle the $2 quadrillion shell game that essentially is the business of planet Earth now. It's all, we've got a financialized global economy that vastly exceeds the trade in real goods and services. And that's just the way it is. So the dollar is bigger than all the central banks put together. And even now you can get little bits and pieces of what's to come, because the market now, is 100% driven by the dollar. It's, on any given day, if you look and you see that the dollar index is off moderately, at least like 30 or 40, 50 cents, you don't even have to look at the rest of your stock tables, the equity indexes and everything else, because they're all going to be up. And so even though the fund managers come in every morning, and the trade desk guys come in every morning with their own sleazy plan about how they're going to work stocks and essentially steal money from the rubes, they may not know it, but they're really controlled by the dollar. And the dollar is, it's unpredictable from one day to the next, but it is observably driving everything else, every other marketable security, inversely. And as I mentioned, it's predictable. If I just look at the dollar and see that it's up 40, 50, 60 cents. I don't even have to look at the rest of my radar screen. I know that everything else will be down. And conversely, when the dollar is down, when it's weak, it is opportunistically used to drive everything else higher. But there's no question that the market is just reciprocal to whatever is going on in the dollar, pretty much almost on an hour-to-hour basis, although the relationship is more consistent if you take periods of a day. So on any given day, just look at the dollar, and you know what the rest of the markets are doing.
Could we already be in a recession?
Well, we already are, and you and I had it nailed probably 6 months before the rest of anybody. I was referring, when I talked about it, to something a guy in my chat room had mentioned. He is in the shipping pallet business, and you can't conceive of a business that's more closely attuned to trends in business. So here he was saying that pallet sales had kind of slipped, and we took that as an absolute sign that we were slipping into recession. So the question is not whether recession is possible. The question is how many negative growth quarters can we have before the official statisticians start calling it recession?
One of the signs I worry about is I live across from a container ship port in Vancouver, and so many days like today, there aren't any container ships there. And before, it was always packed.
Right, and that's true. I mean, we see it in our own lives. I mean, here's Biden and all the schmucks who work for him telling us that we're not really in recession, and you know, we really have to sort of tweak the definition of recession, but that's a lot of crap. You know, you can just look around the neighborhood and see the number of storefronts that are shuttered, and you need to consider all of the businesses that right now are dead in the water. They're good businesses, but I'm talking about Macy's and Nordstrom's, all the department stores. Virtually all of the movie chains are going to close, and that's going to be leave a big hole in commercial real estate. Cities like San Francisco has, depending on whose numbers you use, 30 or 40% vacancy rate for commercial space. In that respect, the cities are never coming back, not ever. And of course, since all the ground floor amenities are pegged to office towers being filled with people who come down to lunch, have lunch at street level, or go to concerts or use the subway system to get there, all the cities, the big cities, are going to fail. So to speak of whether or not we're in a recession or not, it's a joke. I don't know what kind of clown would be even debating the issue, because there's so many larger things that are weighing on the economy that even the most superficial impression of a rebound it's meaningless.
Bankruptcy trustees are going to be busy?
Somewhere down the road, yeah. I mean, that is essentially the way deflation works. The debts that we owe, which by universal agreement are unpayable. You know, we owe more when you toad up, let's say, Social Security and pension obligations or healthcare obligations, and this applies, of course, to Europe as well. There will never be enough money to pay for them. And to make that point another way, as I always do, do you honestly believe that millennials who, with their art history degrees, living in their parents' basements till they're 35, are they really going to be able to foot the bills for baby boomer Medicare and Social Security? So the way in which those liabilities will be discharged will be not through inflation. You can't inflate a pension or a healthcare system because, like as we're going to discover first in the state of Illinois, it requires sending out hundreds of thousands of checks every month to state employee retirees. And that's the kind of real inflation that doesn't go very far before it turns into hyperinflation. But it won't. We won't go that way because, when Illinois stretches his palms out to Uncle Sam, and by Uncle Sam I mean taxpayers, not the government, there'll be 22 states right behind. And so we won't possibly be able to inflate out of the unpayable liabilities that have accrued in the retirement system and our healthcare. So that's another reason why deflation is absolutely inevitable and inescapable.
Do you have any gems of wisdom for people who are investors or speculators?
I love my friend Charles Hugh Smith's solution, and that is put your speculations aside and start a vegetable garden in your backyard. You know, we've all had a good ride, really, but I think we're kidding ourselves to think that all the excesses of the financial economy that have made it possible for guys like me to sit at a desk in my gym shorts and trade commodities. Well, that's a decadently extravagant system, and it's all going to come to an end. So I think like Charles is doing, he lives in Hawaii, and he's trying to discover the most nutritious things to grow, the things that deliver the most nutrition that can be grown in his backyard. And I think he was mentioning breadfruit in one recent letter. So I would say, as he's doing and suggesting, just cultivate your independence and your resourcefulness.
Rick, how can people sign up for your free trial offer and sign up for your products?
Well, I'm glad you asked again. Very easy. Just go to rickackerman.com, and at the top of the page, there's a bunch of tabs. One says free resources. Click on the free trial subscription, and in less than a minute, you can be accessing Rick's Picks. Free trial, 2 weeks, no credit card necessary. You just have to leave your name and email address, and you'll be in there right away. Be sure to say hello when you enter the chat room. It really is, the two rooms are, I think, some of the best in the trading world. One is geared purely to trading and actionable ideas, and the other, I pretty much let the discussion run in any direction that it wants, and the discussion skews toward libertarian ideas, I would say.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website, rickackerman.com. He was speaking to us from Florida. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and Rick Ackerman. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.